What does the Bible say about creation? And how old is the Earth? Is it billions of years old, as secular scientists say and old Earth creationists say? Or is it only a few thousand years old, as young Earth creationists say? And does it really matter one way or the other? We'll be covering those topics on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all is faithbyreason.net. That is where you will find the blog. You will find categories, archives, tons of information. You will also find our social media links, and you will find this very podcast. So where are we? So far, we have been on the topic of what's the point? What's the point of existence? What is the meaning of life? And we have been examining creation. We know that the cause of existence is the first cause. And now we're looking at how the first cause caused existence, which will get us even closer to answering the question of what's the point of existence. In the last podcast, we looked at the physics behind creation, and we saw how it was not only possible for God to speak the universe into existence, but that it's really the only explanation that makes sense when we get down to the quantum level of atomic structures. So in this podcast, we are going to talk about what the Bible says about creation, since we know that God created it. So let's just jump right into the book of the Bible that talks about creation first, which is, ironically enough, Genesis, the very first book in the Bible. Genesis means the book of beginning, so it would make sense. That's where we start when we're talking about creation. So Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. Ereshit bara Elohim eth shamayim eth eretz. You guys might not speak Hebrew, so maybe I should do that in English. And by the way, my doing that in Hebrew was not just to show off my rather rudimentary Hebrew pronunciation skills, but to serve as a reminder of one of the more important aspects of biblical interpretation, which we talked about in the podcast where we dealt with the Bible, and that is understanding that the Bible was not written in English. Surprise, it was not. It was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic, and we need to keep that in mind when we are trying to interpret and understand the Bible, that it was written in an ancient language to an ancient people who had a certain level of a certain type of understanding. And if we keep that in mind, it will actually help when we are dealing with some of the tougher issues in the Bible, one of those being creation and explaining creation. So if we understand that the Bible is written in Hebrew and that Hebrew has to be interpreted and interpreted into English, then it will really help us when we're getting into some of the more challenging topics. So let's start again, but this time let's read it in English. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Period. That is a complete thought, and that's going to be important. We'll talk about it soon. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Full stop. Verse 2. And the earth was without form and void, or other interpretation will say the earth was formless, chaotic, and desolate. And darkness was on the face of the deep, or the abyss. And the Spirit of God moved or hovered upon the face of the waters. Verse 3. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. Verse 4. And God saw that the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And evening and morning, or Erev and Bokor, were the first day. And again, I'm not showing off my rudimentary Hebrew pronunciation. The evening and morning, or Erev and Bokor, are going to be very important when we talk about the timing of things a little bit later. And so the bulk of the rest of this podcast is really going to be focused on just those five verses, because there's a lot of stuff in there that we need to get to. And the rest of the story is, the rest of the narrative, the creation narrative, is pretty familiar to us. God created light, and then on the first day, which is, I guess we call it Sunday, then he separated the waters from the earth, and the earth came forth, and he made grass and trees and vegetables and things like that, and he created the sun and moon and the stars, and then he created animal life, and then he created man. So we all know that. All that's pretty familiar. But I really want to focus on those first five verses, because there's a lot of stuff in there that, while it seems familiar, I think if we look into it a little deeper, we're going to find some surprising things. But before I get back to examining these verses, I want to set some context, because it's really important to set that to set the context correctly, because if you don't look at it in the right way, if you don't look at the entire creation narrative, which is Genesis chapters 1 and 2, then you're going to run into some problems. And one of those main problems is the brevity of those first two chapters. Because all of creation, everything we see, smell, touch, and hear, is just confined to these two chapters, and it's pretty brief. But there's a reason behind it. Unfortunately, a lot of folks either don't know or don't care to know the reasoning behind the brevity. So secularists and even some Christians alike have been very critical of the creation narrative of Genesis 1 and 2 because of the brevity and because of the fact that it doesn't go into detail. It doesn't talk about it. It just says, you know, God created herb-bearing seeds and all these, you know, all the trees and grass and flowers and everything we know of is just contained to that one verse. And even when in verse 16, when it said God created the stars, it's almost like an afterthought. It said, oh yeah, and God made the stars too. And stars are not simple things. They're these gigantic nuclear furnaces out in the middle of outer space that are you know, made up of hydrogen and helium. And they're just these spectacular forms of energy. But again, it's barely a sentence is dedicated to it. So this has led a lot of people to be critical of these verses for that reason. In fact, a friend of mine, more accurately, a coworker, several years ago, he was an atheist. And as you probably remember from some of our earlier podcasts, I don't really have a high tolerance level for atheists. But I hung out with this guy. He was a good guy overall, aside from his unfortunate atheistic brain damage. And we would talk about God. God would always come up because, you know, atheists, even though they claim not to believe in God, they always want to talk about him for some strange reason. Anyway, we would often get into discussions about creation and evolution, and he would use Genesis 1 and 2 as one of his favorite launching points for his attack, saying, oh, you know, the Bible was written by these primitives who didn't understand what was going on. They didn't understand science. They didn't understand the complexity of life. So they just kind of glossed over it. And that's why the writer of Genesis, who was Moses, really only talked about them in the briefest and most rudimentary ways. And the real science shows that things evolved and they're more complex and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not going to get into that too much right now because, well, we're going to talk about evolution in the next two podcasts, and we'll show how idiotic and utterly impossible and just downright dumb the theory of evolution is. But I appreciated him challenging me because it helped me get a better understanding and dive deeper into what the truth really was. And, you know, and as you'll see in the next two podcasts, evolution is completely false and creation makes much, much, much more sense. We saw that in the last podcast and we'll keep seeing it over the next couple, three podcasts. So, but here's the thing. He actually kind of had a point. If the purpose of Genesis 1 and 2 was to give a comprehensive, detailed overview of cosmology and zoology and the flora and the fauna of life, then it really doesn't do a very good job. It actually does a pretty terrible job. It really just glosses over these really complex aspects of life and plant life and animal life and cosmology and astronomy. He barely touches on some of the most astounding and fantastic parts of the existence in the universe that we live in. And if the point of the Bible, if the point of Genesis 1 and 2 was, again, to give a detailed, comprehensive overview on how God created everything and how it's possible for him to have spoken it into existence, if it was really meant to get that level of detail, then it is an utter and absolute failure. But here's the thing. That was not the point of Genesis 1 and 2. And therefore, since that was not the intention of Genesis 1 and 2, it would be invalid and rather silly to criticize it for not being something it was never intended to be. I mean, that would be like criticizing the works of Shakespeare because there's not a whole lot of math and chemistry in it, and it's not completely historically accurate. Well, that wasn't the point of the works of Shakespeare. Shakespeare was not writing a math textbook or a history textbook. He was writing plays and dramatic interpretations of historical events. I mean, if you were taking a class on Shakespeare and somebody stood up and said, you know, that Shakespeare guy, he's not that great. I mean, yeah, his history's off and there's almost no chemistry in it. Well, you look at him like he was an idiot. Why? Because he's criticizing Shakespeare for not being something it was never intended to be. And that's the same with people who criticize the Bible for not being a zoology book or a biology book or an astronomy book. That's not what it was intended to be. What was it intended to be? Good question. So Genesis is one of the five books that we call the law, the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are the law. They were dictated by God to Moses for a specific reason. And the reason was not to be a textbook on creation or anything else for that matter. The purpose of those five books of the law was to separate and sanctify God's nation of Israel. God chose Israel to be his nation. As to why God needed a nation, we'll get into that when we talk about the third dispensation after the flood and Nimrod and all that stuff. If you want a preview of it, you can go to the blog and look up the law. You can look up the third dispensation. We talk about how the earth went from a group of people to a group of nations. But the point is that God wanted Israel to be a set of them with that distinctiveness and to really draw them out and help them be something that was separate from all the other nations of the world. And that's why there's so many things in like the Levitical laws that seem a little odd to us, and some of the laws about cleanliness and clean and unclean animals and clean and unclean food and how to deal with people who had disease and so forth and so on. It was to distinguish the Israelites from the other nations. And the other nations all had their origin at Babel. And in Babel was where false religion started and all the false gods came to be. And once God separated the people by their languages, they took all that false religion and all those false religious narratives into every nation of the world, including Egypt, which is where the Israelites had come from. And as a part of that that paganistic false religion was a false creation narrative. And in their false creation narrative, they had the universe being created by many different gods. They'd have the god of water, the god of fire, the god of earth, the god of thunder and lightning, and so forth and so on. And they all got a group credit for creating the earth. Well, Genesis 1:1 is a contrast to that. Genesis 1:1 says what? In the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth. So he's distinguishing the purpose of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, is to say that unlike all the other pagan nations around you, Egypt and all the other Babel derivatives that have the universe being created by multiple gods, you, Israel, you have the true creation narrative that shows that only one God created everything. So that's what Genesis 1 and 2 is. It's not a comprehensive overview. Why? Because Israel didn't need a comprehensive overview. They already knew the creation narrative. They already believed in the supernatural. So Moses didn't need to teach them about creation step by step. They already knew it. It had been passed down to them for generations. What they needed to know, what they needed to have happen to them was a distinguishing characteristic, a distinguishing text that would separate them from the other pagan nations. And that's what Genesis 1 and 2 is. It's a contrast. So all it is a contrast between the true creation narrative and all the other creation narratives. So the only thing in those two chapters is what's different about the true creation narrative of God versus the creation narratives of all the various other pagan religions. So the only way you can validly criticize Genesis is to say, is to somehow prove that it does not validly distinguish the creation narrative of Jehovah God from all the other various and sundry creation narratives and all the other pagan nations, which you can't do. So Genesis does what it says it's going to do. And there we go. So with that said, let's dive back into Genesis 1 and 1 through 5. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, what's really cool about this one verse is that it's a summary statement of everything, and it also conforms with what we know about science. Because in this one verse, we see the creation of time, space, and energy, and matter, which we talked about in the last podcast. In the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and energy, and the earth, or eretz, which is matter. Eretz that later became translated the word we use for earth, but eretz really just means material. It means physical stuff. So in the beginning, time, God created the heavens, matter, energy. Space and energy, and eretz, or the earth, or matter. And pretty cool. So again, that's a full stop. And the next verse, and the earth was without form and void. The earth was formless, chaotic, and desolate, and darkness was on the face of the deep. This is really interesting, because you have God creating the heavens and the earth, and then you have the earth, or matter, the Eretz, being formless, chaotic, and desolate. So why is it formless, chaotic, and desolate? Well, you really only have two options. Either God created matter formless, chaotic, and desolate, or in other words, he created the world in the state of entropy, which we talked about that in an earlier podcast on time, space, and matter. But either he created it in a state of entropy, or something happened to put the world, to put matter in a state of entropy, of chaos. And there are good scholars who argue both sides of it. One set argues that, you know, God created the world chaotic, in a chaotic state, and he, over time, over the next 6 days of the Genesis narrative, made it less and less chaotic. If you notice, at the end of every one of the creation days, it says the evening and the morning, or Erev and Bokor were day one, day two, day three. Erev and Bokor, they came to mean evening and morning, but what they really mean is going from a state of chaos to less chaos. And you would wonder, why would the days be designated as evening and morning? Wouldn't it make more sense to go from morning to evening? Isn't that how most days go? Well, yes, but Erev and Bokor don't just mean evening. They came to mean evening and morning, but what they really mean is going from a state of chaos to a state of less chaos. Evening or the night would be in the thematic vernacular of the ancient peoples, you know, the time of chaos. You couldn't see at night. It was dark. It was chaotic. But as morning started to dawn, you would see a little bit of light, and you would be able to see things a little more clearly after that, and more and more and more. So things went from chaos of night to much more orderly daylight. So that's Erev and Bokor. And so people who believe that God created the world in a chaotic state and he just brought it into order. And they liken it to how a sculptor starts off with a formless and chaotic, you know, block of marble. And with his hammer and chisel and intelligence, he starts making it more and more orderly until it becomes a sculpture of a horse or a man or whatever he's sculpting. Or when a potter starts with a formless and chaotic lump of clay and he starts spinning it on the potter's wheel, and it becomes less and less chaotic, and it becomes, you know, a pot or a vase or whatever. Or a painter starts with just these blobs of color and a blank canvas, and it's chaotic, but he takes his brushes and he starts making it more and more orderly until you have this great picture. And I understand that, and there are some folks who I respect greatly who believe in this God created chaos and then brought it into order. But I have a serious problem with it, and I think my serious problem with it comes from logic and reason. And the main logic is you cannot create chaos. It's metaphysically impossible to create chaos. Chaos isn't a thing that exists on its own. Chaos is a measurement of the lack of order. You can't create chaos. You can only take something orderly and make it more chaotic. So you have to have order to begin with. I mean, it's like, say, good and evil. You can't create evil. Evil is a measurement of a corruption of good. You can't create darkness. Darkness and light, you have to have light first, and darkness is a measurement of how little light there is. I mean, you can bring light into a dark room. You can bring a candle or a light bulb into a dark room, but you can't bring a ball of darkness into a light room. That's not how it works. Same thing with cold and heat. Cold is a measurement of a lack of heat. You can bring heat into a room, but you can't bring cold into. You can't generate cold. Cold is a measurement of a lack of heat. And even with the refrigerator that cools your food, it doesn't create cold. All it does is dissipate. The Freon gas causes things to slow down more, and it dissipates heat faster. So your refrigerator isn't making things colder. It's just making things less hot. I know that sounds like I'm talking in a circle, but scientifically, that's what it is. And with chaos, you can't create chaos. Chaos doesn't exist on its own. Chaos is a measurement of a lack of order. So you have to have order before you can have chaos, just like you have to have hot before you can have cold. You have to have dark before you can have light. So God cannot create chaos. Not only can he not create it, it would be against his nature to create chaos. So I don't believe that he could have created the world in a chaotic state. That's not just my opinion from metaphysics. It's also right there in the Bible. If you look at Isaiah, chapter the book of Isaiah, after chapter 45, verse 18, it clearly says that when God created the world, hold on, I'll actually read it to you. "For thus saith the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is no other." Now, let's go back to the Hebrew in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And it says the earth was formless and void and chaotic. The word in the Hebrew is tohu vabohu. So formless, chaotic, desolate, tohu vabohu. So God, it said, and the earth became tohu vabohu. Well, if you go to that verse I just read, Isaiah 45, 18, when it said, "Who is God who formed the earth and made it, who established it? He did not create it in vain." That word vain is tohu. It's the same word. So it's saying right here in Isaiah, God is saying he did not create the world to be formless and desolate and chaotic. He's saying right there, he didn't create the world that way. So if God didn't create the world in this formless, desolate, chaotic state, then someone else had to. Well, who could the someone else be? Well, who else was there at creation? Well, I guess you could say one of the other members of the Trinity, but we've already looked at the Trinity and the podcast on the Trinity, and they are all credited with creating the earth. The Holy Spirit is credited for creating it here in Genesis, when the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, moved upon the water, and then he created light and so forth and so on. God the Father is credited with creating it in the book of Job and Psalms and elsewhere. And Jesus is credited with creating it, the Son, in first chapter of John and also in Colossians. So they didn't do it. They didn't make the world. They didn't turn the world chaotic. That wouldn't really make any sense. Oh, hey, I'm going to make this world and then I'm just going to watch it become chaotic. That's silly. So that means that someone else or someone's else must have made it that way. Well, were there other entities around at the creation? As a matter of fact, the Bible says there were in the book of Job. Job's a very interesting book. I don't really go over it in detail in the blog. It's a separate study that I highly recommend. It's a pretty familiar story. You probably know it. It's sort of a wager, for lack of a better term, between God and Satan over Job. Job is a really good guy who has a lot of material wealth, and Satan challenges God and says, "Hey, he's only faithful to you because you made him healthy and wealthy. And if you take that away, he'll curse you." And God said, "Okay, yeah, we'll see go for it and see what happens." And Satan takes away everything, and Job really acquits himself well. He doesn't curse God, but he still wonders why these bad things happen to him. And I'm getting off on this tangent, but I'm just going to do it anyway. One of the things that people say about Job is that the purpose of the book of Job is to answer the question of why good people suffer. Well, if that's the intention of Job, then it does a poor job of it, because Job never finds out why he suffered. He never learns about this wager between God and Satan. Job just wakes up one day and gets the crap kicked out of him, and then he kind of complains about it and wonders what's going on. And then finally, after a while, after his three so-called friends try to comfort him, and those are his friends, he doesn't need enemies. If they try to comfort him, then finally God comes and answers him. But God never tells him why these bad things happen to him. All God does is really give him a science quiz and basically says that, "I'm God, I know more than you, so you don't have the proper perspective to question why I do what I do." So the purpose of Job is not why do the righteous suffer. The purpose of Job is to say you need to have the divine perspective in order to really understand God. Anyway, so back to the topic. When God is giving Job this science quiz, one of the things he asks him, he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth, when the morning stars," this is in Job chapter 38, "when the morning stars sang for glory and the sons of God sang for glory." So there were these some entities in place called the morning stars and the sons of God who witnessed creation and sang for joy. Well, they had to be intelligent because they sang and they had joy. So obviously, before God created the material world, he created these spiritual entities called the sons of God, or the B'nai HaElohim. We'll talk about them quite a bit more when we get to the flood narrative. But these are the beings we call angels, or Malach in Hebrew. So these angels were there, and so they were the only ones there other than God. So they had to be responsible for that chaotic state that the world is in. And there was one angel in particular, the very famous angel named Lucifer, who was we learn about him in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 38. I'll let you look into that on your own, and we'll talk about him in great detail in the Know Your Enemy series. You can look that up on the blog if you want a preview. It's actually one of the more popular series on the blog, the series about Satan and fallen angels. But to be very brief, Satan rebelled against God, and I believe it's because he knew that God was going to create man, and man would be in a special position that Satan was jealous of, and he convinced some number of angels to rebel with him. If you look at Revelation 13 as that historic overview of all time, which I've talked about in the God and Time podcast, possibly a third of the angels rebelled with him, and of course they lost the rebellion. And I believe, this is my speculation, but it's shared by a lot of other really good scholars, that there was some type of judgment, that creation, God created the heavens and the earth, and he created them perfect and orderly. There was this rebellion, and as part of the judgment, the universe became chaotic. And I think that's because the angels, specifically Lucifer, and those angels were given charge over creation, and God judged it by literally destroying it and putting it into a state of total entropy. And the rest of the creation narrative from, you know, from Genesis 1 verse 3 all the way through the second chapter is God recreating the universe and bringing order out of the chaos, but he didn't cause the chaos. So this area of where all this stuff happened, this angelic rebellion between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, is something called the gap theory. Now, let me explain something here. There's some of you who may be familiar with the gap theory, and a lot of old Earth creationists use the gap theory to explain the age of the Earth. Because, again, there was obviously a gap of time between God creating the heavens and the Earth and this rebellion happening. We don't know how long that was. It could have been a few days, years, hundreds of years, thousands of years. Maybe it even was millions of years. And when old Earth creationists look at some of the ways that secular folks measure the age of the Earth, with the carbon dating and the redshift of stars and things like that, I'm not going to get into it because we're getting low on time now. But there are lots of measurements of the age of the Earth that make the Earth look very, very old. And it embarrasses some Christians because if you look at the Bible narrative, the history of man has only been a few thousand, maybe somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 years. And so the old Earth creationists are a little embarrassed by that. And they say, well, you know, yeah, man's only been around for about 7,000 to 10,000 years, but the Earth itself has been around for millions or billions of years, as these aging factors say. And we can account for that age by the gap theory. There was this gap of time. And again, I do believe in that gap of time. However, and maybe that does account for some of the aging factors of the Earth, but some of the old Earth creationists also put things like dinosaurs and, you know, the ancient animals that were allegedly gone extinct millions of years ago into that gap. And you can't really do that because death doesn't exist until Genesis chapter 3. So those dinosaurs and whatever did you try to stick into that gap theory couldn't have died then. And also, physical life didn't exist yet. God did not create any animals, including dinosaurs, until later on in Genesis chapter 1. They were not created in that gap of time. So then that brings up the question that I started the podcast with. How old is the Earth? Is the Earth billions of years old, as secularists and old Earth creationists say? Or was the Earth created in 6 literal days and is only a few thousand years old, between 6,000 and 10,000 years old, as the young Earth creationists say? And this is a big debate. And it rages, and they keep assaulting each other with things like, you know, the carbon dating, which shows that, you know, the Earth and the animals in the Earth are carbon dated millions and millions of years, and, you know, the redshift of stars show that the stars have been rushing away from the center of the universe at a certain rate of speed and time, which means that the universe is 14 or 15 billion years old. Then the young Earth creationists will say, well, that, you know, it's impossible for the Earth to have been that old because things like the Earth's rotation is slowing down at a pretty predictable rate. And if you extrapolate that back, which means it was going faster, you know, in the past. And if you extrapolate that back 6 to 10,000 years, it's not that big a deal. However, if the Earth is millions of years old, it would be rotating so fast that during the time of dinosaurs, it would have been rotating so fast it would have launched the dinosaurs off the Earth at escape velocity. And so I use that to look at the salinity of the oceans, and the oceans, you know, are progressively getting saltier. And if you go back millions of years, it would not have had enough salt in it to have been viable. You know, you look at the magnetic field of the Earth, which is, you know, gradually decreasing, which means in the past it was greater, which wouldn't have been a big deal maybe if the Earth was, you know, 10,000 years old. If 10,000 years ago, the magnetic force would have been so strong that people would have been able to feel where north was by the iron in their blood. However, if the Earth was millions of years old, the magnetic field would be so strong that it would literally pull the iron out of our blood and would instantly kill us. So that's what the young Earth creationists say. So there's a debate back and forth. There's tons. You can go to Answers in Genesis, and you can go to different other websites that take both sides. And by the way, I know we're about over the 30-minute mark, so this is going to be a little bit of a longer podcast, so I apologize for that, but I want to finish making my points. So is the Earth young or old? Well, here's the thing. It doesn't really matter for one simple reason. We have our friend Albert Einstein showed us about 100 years ago that time is not absolute. Time is relative. So if time is relative, you can't definitively say how old something is on a cosmic level unless you can tell the person's perspective. See, time affects and is affected by mass, acceleration, and gravity. So how long something happens depends on how much mass, acceleration, and gravity the person who is observing time is experiencing. For example, you have the famous twin astronauts narrative, where you have, you know, two twins, obviously they're the same age. One becomes an astronaut, and he goes to the nearest star, which is Alpha Centauri, at about half the speed of light. Well, when because he's going much, much faster than his brother who's still on the Earth, he experiences time differently. So when he comes back from his trip, it'll take 2 years to go from Alpha Centauri back to Earth. When he gets back to Earth, he's only 2 years older, but his brother is an old man. About 80 years have passed by. Why? Because the faster you go, the more acceleration you have, the faster, the slower time goes. I'm sorry, excuse me, the faster time goes. So he experiences 2 hours, his brother experiences 80 years. And if you do the experiment again and the twin was able to go at 99% of the speed of light, he would come back in half the time in about a year. But when he gets back to Earth, 300 years will have passed. So he'll just be, you know, a year older. But on Earth, 300 years have passed. Why? Because he was going near the speed of light and the Earth is going much slower than that. So time is based on your perspective. And here's something very interesting I found in doing my research. That the scientists say that the universe is 15 billion years old, and the young Earth creationists say that the Earth was created in 6 days. Well, if you were to take someone and take all their weight away, say they were just a spirit, and put them out in deep space where they're perfectly still and not experiencing any mass, no acceleration, no gravity, then take someone else and stick them on the Earth where they are experiencing a lot of gravity from the Earth. They have their own mass, plus they have the spin of the Earth and the rotation around the sun, so they're experiencing a lot of mass, acceleration, and gravity. If you were to take 6 days of Earth time, how would that be from the perspective? How long would that 6 days be from the perspective of someone out in deep space? Well, when that person in deep space experiences no mass, acceleration, and gravity, you know how long that 6 days would be? About 15 billion years. So from the perspective of someone out in deep space, 15 billion years would be the same as 6 days from someone standing on the Earth. So I think that's interesting. I'm not going to use that as my proof point that the Earth was created in 6 days, but I will use it to say that you cannot definitively say how old the Earth is unless you can give the person's perspective. So how old is the Earth? From whose perspective are you asking? Is it from God's perspective, who experiences no mass, acceleration, or gravity? Is it from the perspective of someone standing on Earth? What were the conditions of the Earth when it was first created? How much mass, acceleration, and gravity was it experiencing then? So you don't know that. So since you don't know that, since when you measure something using carbon dating or argon dating or any of the other dating methodologies, you can't accurately say how old they are because you don't know all the factors involved. You don't know what the universe was like at that creation point. So I don't really get into how old the earth is. It doesn't really matter, especially from the creation standpoint, from someone who believes in the first cause of creation. It doesn't matter whether the earth is young or old. It doesn't change anything. Now, if you're an atheist, if you're a secularist, an evolutionist, it does matter because the earth can be young. Because if the earth is young, then you can't account for the millions of years that are required for evolution. So whether the earth is old or young, you know, I'll let the young versus old earth creationists go at it. I don't really care. It doesn't affect my theology at all. Now, but if the earth is young, it does affect your worldview if you are a secularist. So I hope that was clear. Probably wasn't. Feel free to talk to me about it in the comments, and I'll try to explain it a little better. I'm sorry I was a little crunched for time. I didn't plan my time out well enough on this to try to get everything in half an hour. But again, young versus old, I don't worry about it because it's really a matter of perspective. And those things that the factors that people use to age the earth, those only work if everything is in a steady state of being. You can only use accurate carbon-14 and argon dating if everything has been equalized and if there's been no major events happening on the earth. Everything has to be pristine, and we know that things are not pristine. Things happen quite a bit. The earth gets hit by meteors, and there was great flood and all sorts of things that have happened to show that you don't have that steady state model in order to accurately say what the carbon dating is. And there have been some famous mistakes in carbon dating. Someone found a hat that got fossilized during the gold rush in the 1800s, and someone carbon dated that hat to about 14,000 years. You know, that's not the case. And then even using the redshift of stars, which is, you know, the shift in the red spectrum showing the stars are going away from the center of the universe at a certain rate. Well, there are also stars that are shifted to the blue, which is the opposite side of the spectrum, showing that there are some stars that are going the opposite direction. So you can't even use redshift. So these dating things are unreliable. And again, when you get right down to it from the theological standpoint, the age of the earth and the universe, based on the tools of measurement that we have, just don't really make one whit of difference in proving or disproving the first cause. It only makes a difference if you believe in evolution, which we're going to start talking about in the next podcast. So I'm going to let's wrap this up. I think I covered everything I wanted to cover here. Again, if you have questions, please send them into the comments, not in email. I keep getting a bunch of stuff from you guys in email, and I appreciate it, but I'd rather you put it on the comments. Facebook. Please remember to follow us on Facebook. And starting the next podcast, since I'm such a fair and generous and magnanimous person, I am going to give the opposite worldview. I've been talking in the last two podcasts from the worldview of a Christian, talking about God creating the world. And in the next podcast, I'm going to give the democratic opposition. I'm going to talk about evolution. And I'm going to talk about it from a scientific standpoint. I am not going to dismiss it based on any faith-based beliefs or Bible-based beliefs or anything like that. I'm going to let evolution stand on its own. And when you see evolution standing on its own, you will realize that it is a ridiculous, horrible theory. It is impossible. Not unlikely, not improbable. It is impossible, idiotic, ludicrous theory, which for some interesting reasons is still the dominant worldview of the earth. I'm sorry, still the dominant worldview of our current culture and society. So be with us next week. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's going to be great. We're going to dive into evolution in the next podcast, and the podcast after that, we're going to get into the philosophy of evolution. So next podcast is going to be the quote unquote science of evolution. And I put science in quote because evolution is utterly scientifically impossible. And in the podcast after that, we're going to get into the philosophy behind Darwinian evolution and why it's such a dangerous thing. So again, thanks for listening. Sorry I went a bit over time. Send me your comments. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter. And until then, I will talk to you soon.